Meeting of the PAC to order at 1:35 on National Pi Day. I hope you're all eating circular items today. The first item of business I'd like to do this afternoon is call for the approval of the February minutes. So I trust you've had a chance to read them over. And I would entertain a motion for approval. Moved by Marshall and seconded by Dolores. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions. Seeing no one opposed nor any abstentions. Thank you. I know Naomi is not here today, so Randy, are you going to be given the Equity and Access Subcommittee report?
Sure. I came in late to it, so... but we did review, there was a new JARC funding round that went out, and some of us from this committee sat on the screening committee for that. So there was a discussion about what that is and what this new funding is. And it centers around mobility management coordinating, which was, I think, a great thing to be moving forward as a regional body. And then we talked, we just had a brief informational item on the Coordinated Public Transit Human Services plan, and that will be coming back to us. And I don't think that there was anything else. Like I said, I came in late. Richard?
Subcommittee members, anything else? Richard?
Oh, no, that was it. She covered it pretty well.
Great, thank you. Then let us go to our first item, the Transit Sustainability Project. And I believe Alex and Ken Fullen are going to hit us up with this item. Yes.
This is not on this, but I just would like to make a suggestion that we let Pam bring her to the forward in the agenda rather than at the end, because several times she has not gotten to speak, and she spends a lot of time preparing this. And she doesn't want us to do that, but I would like to know what she has to say or questions. So if we could maybe incorporate that into the agenda so that she gets moved.
Let me figure out how to do that best, Dolores. What I will do is make sure that we're adjourning on time today and that her report is fully heard beforehand.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think it's probably just needs to be better management on my time. So, but thank you. I understand there's been some minor changes to the document before us, or the one that came over the email, and so, Ken, why don't you go ahead and explain it to us? Or Alex.
Kenneth is going to do the presentation, so I'll go ahead and let him get started.
Okay, I'll certainly point out the changes. It's to two slides. Kenneth Fullen, MTC staff. I was here last month, and you all had some specific requests to come back this month for the Transit Sustainability Project. Just to give you a picture of where we're at, the Policy Steering Committee is meeting for the last scheduled meeting tomorrow. And then on March 28th, the recommendations would be released by a committee of our commissioners. And the actual adoption of the project is scheduled for April 28th. So we're on somewhat of a tight time frame here. Last month, the information that this council had requested was sort of information on current auditing and performance measure process, as well as how agencies are performing against the metrics that we are actually considering as part of the staff proposal, and then to give an update on the latest staff recommendations, and of course to allow time for you to give some input before the recommendations are released. So to start quickly through what's in place right now, the current performance measures, standards, and auditing process, just to let you know, this statistical summary is something that's available in the library, and it's online. It's produced each year, and it has a great wealth of data, both at the regional level as well as at the agency level. So that's something that's available. There are state-mandated TDA audits, Transit Development Act audits, that occur on a cycle that agencies are audited every third year. It's administered by MTC, and it's done by a private independent consultant who comes in And then on the RM2 side, what it is route specific metrics that are based on the RM2 legislation. And some background information on the triennial audit. Again, it's every 3 years, and there is a kit of five TDA performance indicators that are the primary measurements taken in this audit. This is some of the information that is presented usually in October to our commission. That kind of gives a snapshot of how the agencies are doing, and this is the information on the Big Seven operators from audits over the last 3 years. Basically,
Dolores, do you mind using the microphone or repeating the question?
I'm sorry. I wondered what the arrow that was he said it's neutral.
Yeah, green is good and up, red is down and bad, and yellow is yellow. And these are some of the summary findings from audits over the last three-year period. Again, it's kind of identifying what are the major cost drivers and how they are doing on the five metrics that are being tracked. And it gives a summary trend. Some are stating the obvious that large operators tend to have higher costs than the smaller operators, but it does give some information on service effectiveness as well. On to the Regional Measure 2 performance standards, it only applies to the routes that are funded by Regional Measure 2. And again, it's route by route, and the farebox standard on what must be recovered by the route is listed there. And the standard, once the funding is available to the route, it must be achieved within a three-year period. And if the standards are not achieved, there is a process in place that tries to correct whatever the problem might be, and there is always the potential that the commission could redirect the funds to another route or make modifications. This is just some information from the last time we did this. In October of 2011, and that gives you a look at which routes were meeting the standard, and there's also one in there that was unlikely to meet the standard. Now on to the specific findings and recommendations from the Transit Sustainability Project. We did go through these last time with you, so I'll just try to highlight where the changes occurred. And this is a snapshot of really why we got into the project. You saw this last time and once before as well. The operating costs are increasing at a rate much higher than the vehicle hours, revenue vehicle hours. And finally, what's increasing at the slowest clip is the actual trips or passengers. So we're trying to kind of turn that around and get a better return on the operating cost investment. Now, this is the first of two slides that is different than what was in your packet, and we have revised this based on what will be going to the Project Steering Committee tomorrow, and it's really, it has to do with this first statement, reduce real operating costs per service hour or cost per passenger by 5% within 5 years and no growth beyond CPI thereafter. When we came to you last month, it was only cost per service hour, and it was 10% within 5 years. So after further direction from our select committee of commissioners, as well as the project steering committee, we have revised this downwards to 5% and added a new indicator. So it's not just cost per hour, but the agencies would be able to meet the cost per hour or cost per passenger. And again, only a 5% improvement in this scenario within 5 years. And last time, there were a couple questions on how are the agencies doing against these metrics. And this shows how agencies are doing from 2008 to 2011 on the cost per revenue hour metric. And as you can see, at this point, two agencies have met or are close to meeting it, while the other agencies have some work to do. So AC Transit and BART, those two agencies have either met or are close to it, and other agencies are between 7 and 12% above the baseline. And quickly on the financial metrics, the monitoring, it would be, again, over a five-year period. We would want the agencies to adopt some sort of a strategic plan immediately in 2013 that sort of identifies a path forward on how they will be meeting the metrics, and then a report to their boards and to MTC in the interim years. And finally, the first year of compliance would be in fiscal year 2019. Another area that on the financial side is seeking new revenues. A regional gas tax is one under consideration. We do have polling data that will be released on March 28th to the select committee, so we'd be able to get you some information on what that polling data looks like. And, of course, supporting any local measures that are consistent with the TSP objectives. On the service side, these are two components that we went through last time with this group. There's an investment program that has been kicked off with a $30 million investment focusing on improving speed on urban trunk routes. And then secondly, an incentive program that we're recommending would move forward that is essentially rewarding agencies based on improvements in ridership and service productivity. On the institutional side, there are maybe four or five slides in here that kind of outline the possibilities and the recommendations. I just want to kind of try to sum it up by saying that what we are really asking for is that the agencies consider coordination and the customer's perspective in all policy and business decisions. That's number one. Number two is when it makes sense that they consider kind of consolidating in functional areas. And finally, more of a long-term goal is, again, where it would make sense if there is opportunities to do a full consolidation that would make it a better experience for the customer as well as a good financial business decision, then that would be something to pursue as well. So these recommendations span, you know, different areas, capital planning and resource sharing here, as well as various areas of service planning. And moving on to some paratransit recommendations as well, that we reviewed last time with this group. And again, some focus recommendations on small operators that are focused on fares, the service and capital planning, customer service. And finally, some institutional consolidations, some that are already underway, and then based on how those goes to try to apply lessons learned to other areas where it might make sense. This last bullet is important, I think, as well, is not just considering transit by itself, but at times you look at it as part of the entire transportation system, and you look at a couple models throughout the region where the policy decisions are being made for transit, for sales tax expenditures, as well as for highways and roads by the same authority and the same elected officials. And VTA is a good model for that, as well as the recent merger of the CMA, congestion management functions, and the sales tax authority in Alameda County. So that is it in a nutshell, and I think we're here today to kind of put these in front of you again and see if this council wanted to take a position either on all of the recommendations or certain recommendations. And we've tried to outline them here. One note on this first financial recommendation, it's really the first step is identifying the metric, and then the second step is setting a target, and that's where we're at right now. The next step would be to identify the enforcement policies and consequences. So I think it, as part of our recommendations, we're recommending those first two steps, and the actual policies about enforcement would come later. The service piece we've outlined in the institutional, there's varying steps of what we could take there. So with that, I think I can give it back to you, Dolly, and see if you all wanted to consider it, looking up at this here.
Thanks very much for your report, Kenneth. I just want to make sure that on page 26 of our document, it's that first bullet point that has changed in terms of the position on recommendations. It goes back to what Kenneth mentioned in his report, 5 years at 5% and then no growth thereafter, or not to exceed the CPI as opposed to the 10% here. These are the recommendations that are being asked of us to approve, and these really are our policy statements as we go forward. That's what the board is looking for us to debate today. And so with that, and knowing our time limit, I would love to take a list of speakers. I'm going to presume, Lori, you're going to be the first one, since it seemed like you had a question early on.
Thank you. Just a brief question regarding the AC Transit and BART not meeting their standards and so or their goals. And so the possibility of them losing funding, is that a strong possibility that that funding would be redirected somewhere else, to another, maybe to another transit agency?
Yeah, the slide that you're referring to, it's actually the opposite. It's that AC Transit and BART are doing the best out of all
the
operators
okay.
right now.
Oh.
But to your question, is it a possibility that certain funds could be taken from an agency that isn't doing well and given to a different agency? That would depend upon whatever type of a policy we develop for enforcement. And I think that we've had some discussions with the operators and with the steering committee that is a possibility.
Okay. And do you think that service in certain areas where performance is not that great, that you could increase that service? I mean, because, for example, in the city of Vallejo, which is where I represent, but I work in the city or for the city of Richmond. Now, in the city of Richmond and Vallejo, there's a lot of areas where they don't have bus shelters. So don't you think that if we directed some of the funding towards the development of bus shelters, that could, in fact, help some of these transit agencies by increasing ridership?
Yeah, I think that's a definite possibility. One part of the recommendations, if you look up what's there right now, is on the service side, there is an investment category.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the first part of that investment is a $30 million investment that's available for AC Transit, SFMTA, VTA, and SamTrans to make improvements that would improve the service and speed up the route so that you get more ridership. As for specific things like the bus shelters, there are other MTC programs like the Lifeline program that have a lot of capital funds for things like that. So it's not necessarily just looking at the financial piece by itself, but I think we have complementary pieces that would really attempt to make everybody succeed at this. The idea isn't to be punitive.
Okay, so if this committee decides in the sometime, I guess, between now and approval of this, that we like to have more specific language related to some of the financials going towards the construction of bus shelters to ensure that each transit agency that receives some of this money have to put so much money towards the building of shelters and the maintenance of them. Is that a possibility? I mean, I heard you say the Lifeline, but that's just one. Sometimes, but a lot of times that Lifeline does not, they don't really use it for that purpose. A lot of the transit agencies don't.
Excuse me, Ken. One of the things I want to do is recognize that we have three pretty big issues on here. And I don't think it's NTC's role to decide where the operating dollars would go in a particular area. I think, Laura, I'm going to ask him to ask you to wrap up your questions, because what I want to do is talk about the policy, about the literal policy about how do we save money and make transit sustainable. We haven't saved the money yet, though, so I don't want to start talking about how do we re-spend it once we save it, until we get the policy on how to save it and how to cooperate and collaborate more as a region. So if I may just interject there.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair, but I may still come back to this question for an answer, some type of, or if not an answer, some type of recommendation that you could give this committee. All right, thank you.
And I think it's fully within our discretion to consider in the future, how do we spend money? How do we suggest the board spends money that they end up saving in other areas? And so that's the policy question, but it's not specific to this item necessarily.
Okay, like I said, if I find the need to, I may come back to that for a recommendation, if I find the need, after we discuss the rest of this. Thank you.
All right, I have Kathleen, and then Dolores, and then Richard.
In terms of the revised financial goals, I was understanding that sort of initial 10% discussion was being factored into the sustainable community strategy and sort of filling a gap in the future years for the RTP. So what does the change to the 5% do to that revenue generation over the life of the plan?
We would need to make an adjustment to now only look at 5% instead of 10%. So we would need to make that adjustment. I think that based on the feedback we've gotten from the transit operators at this point, I think, and also looking at the data, it suggests to us that the 10% might be a little more challenging, not feasible. So that's why we're now recommending 5%. So we would need to factor that into our plan Bay Area analysis.
Okay. Is that being factored into the transportation scenario that's going to be released next month for the financials in that?
The commission is going to consider sort of the investment strategy in April. So I think that there's still sort of various pieces. It's sort of an iterative process. So, you know, depending on what the commission decides on here, we'll need to kind of factor that in and sort of wrap it all together.
And just a couple other quick things. But in terms of on slide 19, my one concern with the incentive structure is that could, you know, have some regressive impacts by, you know, achieving improvements in ridership and service productivity. There may be, like, the areas traditionally served by Lifeline could be suffering, or in some areas. So, I mean, when you consolidate and try to up productivity on one line, somewhere else is maybe not being served. So I would just ask that we try to consider that effect as we finalize the recommendation. And lastly, on slide 25, at least in my county, I would really support the consolidation of the tax authority and the congestion management agency. It would vastly improve our coordination of transportation enhancements, major infrastructure investments. So, thank you.
Thank you. Dolores?
Yes, Kenneth. I want to thank you again for tackling something that seemed almost impossible when you first brought it to us. Before, you've done a nice job. I only have one question. How do you build into unforeseen financial problems, such as the price of gas, which is going to raise the cost of fuel, whatever they use, increasing? How do you build in unknown things they're going to really affect, in some cases, the financial?
Well, I think the analysis we're doing, it doesn't necessarily have every small sensitivity like that. The example that you gave, it would actually hurt the agencies because fuel would be more expensive, but then on the fare box, it would help the agencies because when the prices of gas go up, then more people are likely to take transit. So, using a number at 10% or 5%, there is obviously, it doesn't have every sensitivity built into it, but we've done a lot of financial analysis and service analysis that demonstrate that it's possible to do this. You know, there are sometimes unforeseen circumstances, but we're trying to do the best with the analysis that we have. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. Three things, they'll be quick. The first is just a comment on the sister's comment about bus shelters. Actually, the TA has been looking at a situation where on some of our lifeline lines are not bus shelters. Sort of coordinates with maybe not in Richmond. We might want to look at funding Lifeline based on how many bus shelters there are along that line. People probably make a decision on whether to go to work or not if they're going to get drenched waiting on the bus. Secondly, congratulations. I think you've done a good job in working on this proposed financial metric. You've actually taken into consideration the fact that many of these workers have taken huge cuts already, and that they're at the mercy of the big banks who have created problems with their pensions and the cost of medical insurance. And thirdly, on strengthening coordination among small operators, I like the standard fare policy, a joint fare policy, but I think we need to take it a step farther and make it a regional fare structure. And I would like for you to look at Los Angeles, whose ridership has increased. They have a regional fare policy. Their fares are quite reasonable compared to ours for going across the region. And they're actually building two new light rail lines. One of them's in construction right now. Thank you. Was that fast enough?
That was. Thank you. Randy?
Thank you. Just Dolores, to follow up on Dolores' question, there's no way then of breaking out the gas-operated lines versus the electric lines versus the mixed lines as far as revenue per hour is concerned, correct?
Some of the data that the agencies report do make that distinction. It's modal. The data that they report to the federal government breaks it down by trolley coach, motor bus, and light rail. So that's certainly out there. When we're talking about the 5% reduction, that is agency-wide, and it's not specific to the mode. So I suppose if in a circumstance like San Francisco, if the price of electricity is going up for their trolley lines and gas is going down, you know, there's all sorts of different things that could be happening. That again, we don't have those specific sensitivities built in, but we still believe that with what we've looked at, that it's possible to make this 5% cut.
Okay, but it's not an apples to apples if you're comparing. I guess there just needs to be for me a little asterisk somewhere that says this is a gas line. This is a group that runs solely on gasoline, which is going to keep going up, so their hourly expenses are going to keep going up versus, isn't BART or, you know, and when we electrify Caltrain. I know, I had to throw a little fantasy line in there, but just when that happens, so just going forward, just from an analytical point of view, when you're only looking at this slide, those differentials aren't anywhere in this slide. So I think that's an important thing to, because in their only way of reducing costs, if electricity, which stays fairly flat, doesn't rise like gas prices, is their benefits that their employees earn. So that's my concern, that we're not doing that kind of a.
Yeah. I think one thing to point out, though, that the fact of the matter is that the labor cost is 75 to 80%. The fuel cost is probably in the area of 5 to 8%. So it is the impact of the fuel fluctuations isn't going to have that effect on the overall picture the way the other areas of the budget would.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. We are virtually out of time on this item. I have one more speaker, Aegon.
Thank you very much, Ken and Alex, for coming back with us. And I think those of us on the council, they're really looking for us to kind of take a position and make a motion about this. And so maybe to that effect, just one quick editorial comment on my own. I think this is great that we've gotten to this point. I think there's much more to do. I think we all know that this is probably in and of itself not going to cut it to do all the things that we want transit to do. But at this point, this is where the negotiations between the operators and MTC have come from. And it seems, based on the comments people have made, that we really ought to support staff in at least achieving what's on the table now. And there's a lot of other pieces in here. I'm going to bring it up at the end of the meeting. I think that this body here could really help MTC think about things like a regional fare policy. It's not a part of the Transit Sustainability Project now. It's been mentioned. It's come up over the years, a lot of you on prior committees. It's not on the table now, and so I wanted to make a motion to support staff, the staff recommendation as it appears now, with the caveat that we're interested in ensuring that there's an appropriate enforcement policy and appropriate incentives over time to operators to grow ridership in the right way that doesn't degrade Lifeline service but really makes transit much more viable for people in the Bay Area in the long run. So the motion on the table would be to support the suite of recommendations as they are, but with a caveat that we think that there's more to be done, and this is an important starting point, and we want to be participants in helping shape additional specifics into the future.
All right, it's been moved and seconded that we support the staff recommendations as presented on our new slides 26. And Aegon, I'm trying to figure out that the appropriate incentive for operators to grow ridership, but I think I missed part of what you stated. It's on the tape. For those of us here, to support Lifeline, grow ridership.
And I think under this incentive, Kennedy, you didn't go into the details today. There is a proposed incentive policy that's around allocating some of the existing MTC funding and potentially new funding based on an incentive around ridership and passengers. And just saying, it's a good start. Let's try to expand that. The idea we shouldn't just be about sticks. We should also be about carrots.
Great. So it's been moved by Aegon, seconded by Randy. I have Marshall and then Rich. And the discussion now is to stick to the motion at hand.
Well, I would defer my comment. It had more to do with regional fares.
Okay. Rich?
My question was, were you also including in this as the added suggestions a regional fare policy?
I think that's probably a topic for a future discussion.
Yeah, I was going to bring that. I think that's a topic we should. It's not on the table right now for recommendations, so I think we should bring that up as maybe new business for this body.
Could we tack it on as just something that we've made note of, that it would be a move that would be appreciated?
I think that starts to muddy our motion to say we feel. So if we could just add that on to under an item for new business. Okay, great. Alex and then Frank.
Okay, I just wanted to make one clarification because what we did send out to the Project Steering Committee, which that mailing happened after yours, we did have one item under service recommendations that said, and again, it wasn't very specific, but said consider fare policies focused on the customer that improve regional local connections. So I just want to note that MTC staff has sort of put that out there, because I think someone said it wasn't yet on the table from us, but it sort of is.
Frank?
Thank you so much for this report. It's quite comprehensive. And one area where I would prefer some emphasis is the consolidation and collaboration, regional consolidation and collaboration to enhance cost savings and improved service delivery. We should look into it to incentivize that particular program.
Okay, no other debate on the motion? Okay, the motion's before you. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions. That motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Alex and Kenneth. I think this really is a first step towards coordination of a regional transportation management, congestion management, and hopefully what will eventually be a seamless system for all of our clients. Thank you. And thank you, committee members, for doing your work ahead of time and asking some and bringing up some thoughtful questions. Our next item is item 6 for the Plan Bay Area Draft Land Use Scenario. Ken Kirky is going to present this item to us. And I understand from Pam there's been some changes in the documents over the last 48 hours. So even the email that was sent to you has evolved already, and I think Ken will point that information out to us. The document before you today, dated today, March 14th, is going to be, I believe, the working document that we will be discussing. All right. Thank you. You have the next few minutes. Thank you.
Ken Kirky with the Association of Area Governments. So last Friday at a joint meeting of the MTC Planning and ABAG Administrative Committees, the jobs housing connection scenario was released. This is the next step in the process of developing the region's sustainable community strategy. We received a lot of local input, local jurisdictional input, related to the alternative scenarios as well as the initial vision scenario. We've also received a lot of stakeholder input into this process. And we've been working with a series of consultants around the housing forecast, the employment forecast, the relationship to income and population. And I'll get into some of the details in a moment. So the jobs housing connection scenario is structured to prepare the region for job growth, to provide a wider range of housing and transportation options for Bay Area residents, in keeping with SB 375 to align transportation investments, future housing growth, and land use planning, and to house the region's population at all income levels. When we first released the initial vision scenario as we were kicking off the SCS process, we received a lot of input on the economy. That given the Great Recession, given some of the structural shifts in the national economy, that the Bay Area couldn't and shouldn't really take its economy for granted anymore. And so we've done a lot of work with a number of consultants looking at economic issues, job growth issues, job growth locational issues, and so forth as they relate to, potentially relate to the sustainable community strategy. So these are some big numbers that we have for you, the control totals for this draft scenario, the jobs housing connection scenario. First, in terms of employment, we're looking at job growth over the next 30 years of about 1.1 million. This is based upon a couple of different assumptions. One, that we have a growing economy, that the national unemployment rate will decrease to 6% by 2018, which historically doesn't sound all that great to me, but that's considered full employment by economists. That the Bay Area's, the nine counties' share of national jobs will increase slightly from 2.4% to 2.5% in 2040. And I think this is very notable, that the Bay Area is positioned to have a strong economy. The approach that we take when forecasting employment is to look at the relationship of the region to the nation and to do that across roughly a dozen sectors, employment sectors. The sectors that are related to knowledge, the knowledge-based sectors that the nation is expected to do relatively well with in the coming years over this period, are sectors that this region does extraordinarily well with now. We have Silicon Valley. We are the center of every technology sector that exists. This is where a lot of those jobs want to be. A lot of what the scenario is about is creating a basis for those jobs to grow here by providing enough housing tied to transit in key locations for our workforce going forward. In terms of population, we're looking at an increase of about 2.1 million over this 30-year period. That's mostly related to natural increase, more people being born than dying in this period. But it's also related to job growth, and I'll get into that in a moment. And then in terms of housing units, we're looking at 660,000 housing units over this period. That's tied directly to the job number. It's a somewhat more modest number than the previous scenarios that we've released, and I'll describe why that is in a few moments. So first, in terms of employment growth, again, 1.1 million jobs by 2040. It's important to note a couple of things with that. One is that that assumes 300,000 unemployed Bay Area residents will be back in the labor force between now and 2020, between 2010 and 2020. So a lot of that is just recovery from the last recession in this first decade. Overall, this is somewhat more modest growth than occurred in the previous 30 years. So it's actually a more modest forecast in that sense relative to employment growth. The location of employment growth shifts quite a bit. It's a more focused growth pattern, with roughly 66% of the jobs moving to priority development areas. So that's 743,000 jobs out of 1.1 million. The spatial implications of that are fairly significant. We've looked at sort of the array of places where jobs go and where they tend to go in this region. Regional centers are our region's big urban downtowns, downtown San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose. Given the growth in knowledge-based jobs and a trend toward locating those jobs close to transit, and the fact that a lot of the workers for those jobs increasingly want to be in urban environments and be able to get to work either by walking or biking or taking transit, we think there's reason to believe that the level of jobs in those communities will increase during this period. This region is the land of the office park. Office parks are a big challenge for us in terms of trying to reduce how much people drive, particularly related to work commutes. We think office parks will continue to be very important, but that they're going to evolve during this period. A number of jurisdictions have been letting us know through the SCS development process that their office parks are changing. They're becoming more intensified in terms of the numbers of employees. In a number of locations, the development community that owns those parks or is working with those cities are adding more amenities for workers. They're increasing transit connectivity either through private fleets or the public system. And in some cases, they're adding significant housing on site to make them more of a complete community. So we see some pretty big changes there occurring over this period. Some of the smaller and mid-sized city downtown areas and transit corridors are likely to add jobs, and that's largely related to new housing. As there is more housing in some of these areas in their priority development areas, there will be residents serving jobs in those areas as well. In terms of industrial land, we've, of course, seen big changes over the last three decades. We've lost some major manufacturers in this region, as has much of the country. The economists that we've worked with have said that in terms of big manufacturing entities and employers, we probably lost most of what we're going to lose. Most of what is still here is relatively stable and evolving. It's a more diverse sector. It's more tied to the Bay Area's strengths and its location. Nonetheless, it's probably going to be a stable sector. We probably won't lose a lot of jobs in that sector, but we probably won't see a big increase either. The agricultural sector, in terms of overall number of jobs, is a pretty small sector in a big metropolitan region, but it's an important sector nonetheless, given the wine industry, given some of our specialized agriculture, and given the really big role that our open space and ag sector plays in terms of tourism jobs and a number of other jobs that aren't directly related to agriculture, but are very much supported by that sector. In terms of population growth, again, we're looking at about 2.15 million jobs, additional people through 2040. That's a more modest level of growth than we had in the previous 30 years. That's about 29% versus 40% in the previous 30 years, and a lower 1% per year growth rate versus 1.3% per year. Again, I think it's important to note this information comes from the California Department of Finance, the U.S. Census. It's in part related to natural increase. It's also in part related to the idea that if we have enough jobs here, our children and grandchildren will be more apt to be able to stay here, and some people will be drawn to this region as well as they have been in the past. If we don't grow jobs, we won't have as many people here. It will have an effect on population growth. Arguably, the most notable change related to population over the lifespan of this plan is the huge increase in the senior population. We're forecasting 131% increase in the 65 and over population group. If you look at this slide in terms of 2010, you can see that the senior population right now, or in 2010, is by far the smallest group. It no longer is in 2040, as a lot of us, if we're fortunate enough, have moved into that group. We think that has really big implications in terms of housing choices, housing options, what people will be looking for. In some cases, as they choose to move out of the homes they're now in, they want to be in places that are more walkable, more accessible, and in some cases, probably smaller places as well. We think that's one of the factors that bodes well for significant growth in the priority development areas. We're looking at 65% of the region's total population growth will be in priority development areas. We'll still see in 2040 the majority of the region's population outside of the PDAs, but the percentage will increase fairly significantly. In terms of the housing unit forecast, we utilized a number of inputs. Again, it can't be emphasized enough. We really worked with local jurisdictions. They provide a lot of input to this process. We looked at what their plans say in terms of capacity. The priority development areas encompass roughly 73% of the growth in terms of housing in this scenario. They are all locally nominated. The place types that sort of describe the PDAs in terms of their scale and level of development and transit service, those are selected by local government. So it's a very significant guide to this housing forecast. We also worked with consultants around market analysis. People are generally familiar with the requirements of SB 375 to house the region's population, but somewhat less so the requirement that it be realistic. This is a forecast, and while it's ambitious, we can't have something that's pie in the sky. And so we worked with Strategic Economics, Karen Chappell at UC Berkeley, Stephen Levy, economist, to have outside input and expert input into our analysis and our forecast. They looked at a number of issues, access to employment centers, the role of transit service and enhanced transit service, neighborhood amenities as well. We also looked at vacancy rates, which is something we didn't factor in when we did the alternative scenarios or the initial vision scenario. As I think everyone's aware, the recession had a huge impact on housing in this region, among other things, particularly in some parts of the region. And so jurisdiction by jurisdiction, we looked at the vacancy rate. And we used that in the distribution of housing as a factor relative to how much housing was needed regionally and how much would be distributed jurisdiction by jurisdiction. Right now, we're at a vacancy rate of about 6.4%. 4% is considered a normal. This scenario assumes that we get to a normal rate as we move toward 2040. We also did more analysis in terms of group housing. That's not something we factored into the previous scenarios. There's a basic assumption that with a lot more, many more seniors, we're going to have more group housing, assisted living facilities and the like, and so that has been factored into the scenario as well. In terms of production, looking at this production across the three decades, We assume somewhat lower production in the first decade. That's in part related to vacancies and foreclosures. It's also related to the loss of redevelopment. Given the elimination of redevelopment in California, that's going to have an impact on priority development areas in the near term because it eliminates one of the key funding sources for building this type of housing. There's an assumption worked into the forecast that additional sources or new sources of funding will be found and that they'll begin to have an impact after 2020. This slide just shows the share of units located in PDAs.
Excuse me, Ken?
Yep.
Yeah, just in the interest of time, I think we all have the charts and the data and can see where some counties have grown and some counties have decreased in terms of jobs and employment over the next few pages. I think what's going to be paramount to our discussion is really understanding the key challenges and opportunities
Okay. So
that we have a fair chance to be able to discuss that and then hopefully put forward a motion.
Okay.
If I'm timing this correctly, I hope to have this discussion all wrapped up in about 35 minutes.
Okay.
So
I'll move very quickly through these.
That'd be great.
Total jobs and total housing units. Essentially, you see an array that I think everybody's familiar with. More urban counties take on a lot more growth. It's a focused growth approach. The most rural counties, Marin and Napa, both in terms of housing and jobs, take on relatively limited growth through 2040. This shows percent of employment located in the PDAs. Again, the more urban counties like San Francisco have a very high percentage in the PDAs. The most rural counties have a very small percentage comparatively. That's true for housing units as well. So getting to the key challenges and opportunities. Again, the job growth assumes housing production at accessible locations. This has been a central challenge for this region in the past. When we've tried to grow jobs, we haven't had enough housing. We've choked off the economic growth that we've had. We've lost a lot of jobs and a lot of mid-level jobs over the decades because of a lack of housing. So this plan assumes that the housing production needs to happen. In particular, the 1.1 million jobs, assumes that number of new housing units, 660,000. Our analysis shows that if housing production were increased by roughly 85,000 units above the 660 figure, the region could develop an additional 100,000 plus jobs. The jobs are constrained because given all the analysis we've done, the loss of redevelopment, the challenges of infill, which is significant, back in the 1970s and 80s when the region was building a lot of housing, it was building a lot of housing in greenfield areas in the eastern and southern parts of the region. It's relatively easy to do that when you've got land available. We don't have that land available for the most part in this region anymore. Our greenfield capacity is really limited. And, you know, one of the issues that's come up, particularly it was described in some of the public workshops, that this is sort of moving away from greenfield, moving away from single-family homes. It's not an issue of anybody being moved out of a single-family home. There is a legitimate issue that we don't have a lot of capacity for single-family development within the region. We think that one of the things that moves in the right direction in terms of this scenario is both the increase in the senior population, the likelihood that they're going to want different housing types, the fact that many will move out of existing single-family homes and free up some of that existing stock for family households or households that desire single-family homes, and also the increase in knowledge-based workers create a market demand for this type of housing. So those things all are generally moving in the right direction. One of the challenges is that employment concentrations are not well served by transit. AGON and SPUR have done a lot of work on this issue that I hope many of you are familiar with, but this is a big challenge in this region. Roughly 44% of our jobs are within a half mile of regional transit stations and a quarter mile of frequent local bus. It means most of our jobs aren't well served by transit. A really significant issue there is the last mile issue, particularly on the peninsula and the South Bay. If the transit stations were just a little bit closer to those office parks, it's a lot more likely that people would be taking transit than they currently do. This just shows the relationship of jobs to the highway off-ramps. So in terms of job growth strategies, again, housing production near employment centers is critical. Regional investments to foster job growth in PDAs and improve work access are very important. Most metropolitan regions in the United States, most big metropolitan regions, have a regional economic development strategy. Typically, their MPO and Council of Governments are involved in that. The Bay Area has not had that in the past. We have some significant economic development organizations. We have some sub-regional economic development organizations, but as far as a regional economic development strategy, it doesn't exist. There are some things moving forward. The HUD Sustainable Community Initiative grant that MTC and ABAG received will move in this direction. Some of the work of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute with the agencies and economic development groups will move in this direction. But we think that's going to be really important to make these connections between housing and jobs and transit really work going forward. There is some good news. One is that even through the very tough decade we just came out of, knowledge-based jobs in the region have been growing in priority development areas. These are the sectors that are expected to grow a whole lot more in the coming years, and they've been moving increasingly to priority development areas, so that's a plus. In terms of housing, the affordability gap for housing for very low, low, and moderate income households has actually been getting worse. That's a combination of incomes, loss of jobs, and incomes being at best static. It's also the fact that a lot of affordable housing funding has gone away in the last few years, so that's a really big issue. Again, multifamily housing, infill housing is expensive. The entitlement processes are complex. And the financing is high risk. Even though there's a big demand for rental housing right now, our local jurisdictions in San Jose and some of the communities where rents are going through the roof are running into the reality that private sector developers trying to build this kind of housing when there's a very strong market are still having difficulty getting financing. That's something that will need to change. We still have high vacancies in some parts of the region, a number of foreclosures, significant numbers still to come, and I've talked about redevelopment a few times now. A few of the positive trends are that multifamily development, both in terms of the percentage of housing permitted and the absolute number, has been increasing. So we've started to shift away from having very little, relatively little, 25% back in 1990 to 65% in 2010. And over the last few years, there have been a number of very large rental projects initiated in San Francisco, on the peninsula in Silicon Valley. We've seen an increase in housing in some of our more transit-accessible cities, and I've mentioned the demographic changes that we think are moving in the right direction. Some of the housing production strategies, I'll just touch on a few of these, efficiently subsidize affordable housing, modify existing programs. This could get to HUD funding and other sources of funding that are not tied to the region in any direct way in terms of the priority development areas to prioritize that funding to PDAs. Local regulatory reform and permit streamlining is something that we can do here. And when we talk to developers for and nonprofit who operate in this region and outside of this region, every single one of them describes how difficult it is to work through our processes in this region. And that oftentimes what has happened in the past is that the processes take so long to work through that by the time they get a project through the cycle, they've missed the economic cycle and the project no longer pencils out. We kind of can't keep doing that as we roll forward. We also think, given a shift toward rental housing for many households, that's likely to be a significant change and one that continues on for a number of years, that there needs to be a range of units, family size units for families to actually move into rental housing as a place they're going to stay, not just a transitional spot, but also other sized units for senior housing, for couples, etc. It needs to be a lot more varied than it has been. In terms of the SB 375 requirement to reduce per capita greenhouse gas emissions by 2035, the initial analysis of the land use component, so only the land use component of the jobs, housing, connection scenario, are that it reduces the per capita emissions by about 9%. In April, the transportation investments will be released along with other policy initiatives. Those will be tested at that time relative to GHG as well as the other performance objectives for the plan. I'm going to just touch really quickly on the regional housing need allocation. I'm going to jump right to So RENA was started back in around 1980. It's a state-level requirement. Every region in the state receives a big number. From the state, it's then allocated by the Council of Governments. In that case, in this region, that's ABAG. We've done a lot of work with local jurisdictions and stakeholders, really trying to balance the sustainability component tied to SB 375 and the fair share component that every jurisdiction takes on a share, that we don't over-concentrate poverty, that it achieves some positive results beyond the priority development areas that are sort of the central framework of the scenarios and are likely to be of the SCS. Factors that have been used are transit jobs and RENA past performance. If a community produced housing in the past, they don't have to take on quite so much based upon the proposed methodology. It also includes a minimum housing floor so that every jurisdiction takes on some component of the regional allocation. Because of the economy, because of the impact of the housing crisis on housing availability, the state number is lower for what is going to be an eight-year period. It's 188,000 units roughly compared to 215,000 for a seven-year period last time. For the local jurisdictions, that should make the implementation of these numbers somewhat easier because they have a lot of sites that weren't developed from what is right now the current period of 2007 to 2014. This just shows the timeline. I've touched on most of it. In May, the commission and the executive board, the ABAG executive board, will be meeting jointly to adopt the draft scenario. There'll still be plenty of work going forward after that. So with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Ken. I totally appreciate your brevity also to give us about 24 minutes to be able to debate this. So the question before us, the policy question before us today is, do we send a message to the commissioners that we support this draft scenario that's being developed, that is being forwarded to us today, the jobs housing connection scenario, or don't we? That's kind of the basic bottom line. So if you could relegate your questions to kind of the policy issues that were raised, that would be great. I have Dolores, and then I have Lori. And as I scan quickly, I will take a number of other hands. Thank you. So, Dolores?
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, and it's about the redevelopment funds. I know that there's a story out on the street that this was used for low-income housing, but in my working in public policy in California for many years, I know that it's used for a lot of things that is not even a distant cousin of low-income housing. So in your analysis, did you do an analysis to how much of redevelopment money is used for low-income housing in our area? And the second thing, and I'll be quiet, is there some way that I think redevelopment is a wonderful thing, and I think it should be used for what it was originally designed for. Is there some way in this document that the commission or this committee could advocate for when the economy gets better that redevelopment be reconstituted in a different name, in a different way, and so that it would actually be used for public housing?
Sure. So relative to your first question, there was quite a bit of analysis, some done by staff, but most of it done by Karen Chappell of UC Berkeley, who did a lot of the housing analysis. And she looked at redevelopment both in terms of the role specific to affordable housing. You're right. Redevelopment funding has been used for lots of different purposes, and that's one of the critiques of redevelopment. But there was a significant percentage used for affordable housing. She also looked at it in terms of jurisdictions in the region and priority development areas and how some advanced, pretty significantly because of the availability of redevelopment funds, either in some cases to fund affordable housing, in some cases to make market rate housing occur in locations that without redevelopment funding, the market wouldn't respond. Uptown here in Oakland is a primary example of that. So there's quite a bit of analysis available, and we are going to make the consultant work available, I think, by Friday in more detail, so we can make that available to all the committee members. So there was a lot of analysis that went into it. We definitely saw a correlation between priority development areas that were more successful, particularly in more urbanized communities, having a redevelopment program in place versus those that did not. Relative to your second question, based upon the comments of the Joint Committee last week and some of the comments we received from policymakers generally at the regional level, I think there's a lot of support for potentially having a joint regional legislative strategy that's pretty specific and tries to address some things, such as the loss of redevelopment and what could be put in its place that would be really efficient and successful and would work in the Bay Area. And I know there's some work going on in that front. So, yes, I think that's something that you'll be hearing more about in the future.
Thank you. Lori?
Thank you for the report. I think it was a really good report in the scenario. However, I have a few questions because even though I think that the strategies around policies in terms of encouraging developers to, or cities moving more, making it more, or streamlining the process for developers, okay, to make it simple. I do agree with that strategy because I think a lot of times developers are frustrated. But now where we are with the housing market, with the number of foreclosures, I mean, that's another issue altogether where there's a lot of vacant homes. They're sitting on lots that are where they're foreclosed. And so to build more houses, that scenario doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you have to solve or resolve that issue of foreclosed homes. And so are you going to, or have you even thought about including something in there that deals with foreclosed homes and the number of empty lots or available lots that could meet this goal of the housing job balance? And because I didn't see that in this scenario. And so that's the one thing I wanted to mention. Then the other is around that balance of economic development strategies. I don't always agree that those strategies make a whole lot of sense with what the job the jobs / housing balance or housing production those needs. And so maybe there could be some policy around ensuring that economic development strategies or the housing production jobs balance, whatever, that you can hand out to cities and counties to ensure that they actually meet those goals instead of just, listing them on paper, knowing that they're never going to become a reality. And I guess I said that correctly for you to understand it.
I think I understand the question, the two questions. I mean, on the first one, the vacancy rates and factoring in the vacancy rates by jurisdiction was very deliberate in terms of trying to get to the foreclosure issue. And if you look at the distribution, the housing distribution by jurisdiction, you can see that it's factored very differently in, say, eastern Contra Costa County relative to western Santa Clara County, where the vacancy rates are hugely different and the levels of foreclosure were very, very different. We're saying in some communities that were hit really hard by the housing crisis, you don't need to plan for as much new housing. You don't need to plan for as many additional housing units. You have a high vacancy rate. You have a lot of existing housing that needs to be absorbed in the market going forward. There are other parts of the region, and generally speaking, I'm talking about west of the Bay, from San Francisco down to San Jose, Where the job market has really started to take off in the last 18 months or so, the vacancy rate is pretty low. There aren't a lot of foreclosures, and if the job market continues to grow, there's going to be a need for new housing real soon. And so we're trying to factor that in. It's challenging because it's in a big region like this, different communities are in such different places. Relative to the second question, we think where that piece gets captured is in the relationship of the scenario to the regional housing need allocation. Because the regional housing need allocation, so the short-term housing plan, the eight-year number that jurisdictions have to incorporate into their housing elements and into their general plans, because it's informed by the scenario, the consideration of vacancies and so forth is kind of cooked into that. So a community that has a high vacancy rate that's had a lot of foreclosures is going to see a lower number as a result. A community that has relatively limited vacancies, has real high housing need, would see proportionally a need to plan for more new housing. I don't know if that helps.
Okay, and the second, real quick, one other question real quick, is that I'm trying to figure out who this planning is really for. I mean, because I don't see how this serves the low-income populations and the minority population as much. I see more of a, you know, transients coming into communities of you know, where there's a large population of low-income, and the problem still existing where low-income residents, including seniors maybe, are still plagued with, you know, the issues around, you know, affordable housing possibly and transit, because every time there's a PDA built, it doesn't serve the poorer communities or the poorer segments of the community. Because, you know, when you start living, having those residents live near transit, housing goes up. Everything goes up around there. They cannot afford it. So I'm just trying to figure out where this plan really meets the goals of low-income, minorities, and seniors.
I think there's a couple different ways. I mean, one of the primary tasks of the Sustainable Communities Initiative grant from HUD is to address potential displacement down the road. The One Bay Area grant is structured in such a way that any of the plans would incorporate issues of displacement. Look at, is displacement an issue? RENA requires that, the regional housing need allocation requires that communities plan for housing at different income levels. So it's not just an issue of planning for market rate housing. It's distributed in terms of very low, low, and moderate housing, as well as above moderate. So there's a specific requirement that a community plan for very low and low income housing in those areas. I think the biggest way that it addresses, you know, the very valid concern you've raised is that housing production is critical. Producing less housing is going to make the issue you're describing worse. Producing more housing is going to make it better because there's more capacity for people at all income levels to have places to live. But I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done regionally and at the local level to make sure that housing actually gets developed at affordable levels. And I won't sit here and say that it's by any stretch all solved, especially given the funding gaps we're seeing, which is one of the things we identify in the scenario, that the lack of funding for affordable housing is a really big issue. And the region's going to have to really address that moving forward. And I think the regional agencies are going to have to be, you know, really upfront as we work with local jurisdictions and stakeholders to develop a solid plan for the region and implement it. That's going to be right at the forefront of things that need to be done.
Yeah. Okay. Those two speakers took up about 8 minutes, and so we have literally seven other speakers on the list here, and we have about 12 minutes. So if you've agreed with a comment already, if you wouldn't mind just stating that and not restating the comment, that would be good. If you have a specific question for the policy, that would be best. I have Benna, then Randy, Carlos, Marshall, Tina, Aegon.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment on the locations for new employment. And, you know, I appreciate that you guys put down downtown areas and transit corridors. And where I thought you guys were going with that was to say that places like downtown Palo Alto, where there are a lot of jobs already, would attract new jobs in the future. But what I heard was slightly different. And what you said was that new housing and PDAs would attract more jobs. And I think the first point is still valid. We hear from a lot of companies that they want to be next to other companies. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to look at the existing job patterns and figuring out where future jobs might go. And related to that, on the employment and PDA slide, which was the slide right before, I was wondering if you've put any thought into the different policies that might make companies or might make it more attractive for companies to move into PDAs, because I think that's going to be really important part of all of this. Is how do you help the culture shift for these companies?
Well, in terms of the trends we see, the trend you described is one that we see moving in the right direction. And you know, Dina Belzer with Strategic Economics that we worked with in particular has done a lot of work on this, sort of the issue of agglomeration, that like companies want to be in similar places. And it's beginning to play out in a really big way in the region right now, particularly in San Francisco and on the peninsula. As far as incentives, some of it gets down to, you know, on a most basic level, planning in these areas and making sites available and not making the processes so cumbersome that it's just really difficult to get anything built. There's definitely a market for more jobs in some of these areas. Some of them that are regionally accessible to regional transit are also highly desirable. As far as tax incentives and things of that sort, it gets a lot tougher pretty quickly. You know, I think jurisdictions can do things to make the regulatory requirements a bit easier. But one thing we know when we look at employment regionally is that, with the exception of a small number of bedroom communities, you know, the jurisdictions in the region, because of the tax structure, they're fighting for jobs and they're competing for commercial enterprises. So that's on that front, we think there's more work that needs to be done, and there is policy work that's being developed, and we're going to be releasing a lot more information on that front in the coming weeks and months.
Thanks. Very quickly to follow up on that, you know, absolutely, jurisdictions fight with among each other for jobs, but we see a lot of suburban job growth right now, very low density jobs. And I think in the future, what we're talking about is higher density jobs. And when we have that, we're going to hit up a lot of the same problems housing encounters right now in terms of height restrictions and parking restrictions. So with any policies that we talk about, height and parking should be part of that as well.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you. I've come at this previously from a medical cost perspective, but now I'm going to come at this from a housing perspective. The aging senior population that depends on their fixed income is not going to be able to move into assisted living facilities because, A, we don't have them, and, B, they're expensive. So as they are on a fixed income, the cost of those facilities goes up. What I'm hoping is that out of this comes a potential legislative push, because California is one of a handful of states that does not allow Medicaid money to be used for assisted living facilities. So that affects all of our at-risk and fragile populations, whether they be seniors, whether they be disabled, anybody who depends on Medicaid money that is passed down into the Medi-Cal funding pot is not eligible for these. If we could legislatively free this up, we could reduce, because right now we're pushing that population into nursing care, which is at least 120% more expensive than assisted living, which would also answer the issue that we have on the slides of having more available housing, the larger housing units, for families to actually live in. So we can't take for granted that that shift of our senior population is going to happen, because they're staying put in their homes because they can't afford to go anywhere else. So is there the potential for us to push that legislative agenda along with this, or at least do a comparison so that we can show the value of that type of legislative agenda?
I think there's certainly the potential. As I mentioned, there's a real interest in having a unified legislative push on some of these issues. I think that's, honestly, that's the first time I've heard that issue. It seems, you know, very salient, and I think it's probably something people would be really interested in learning a lot more about.
Well, other states use their Medicaid money to build assisted living facilities, and they use it through their nonprofits, so we need to.
Thank you.
Okay. Carlos.
Thanks, Ken. Really appreciate the presentation, and I wanted to say that I support the strategies and policies that you're putting together here. A couple of things that are kind of two threads, and they might come together at the end. One is the slide you had on the knowledge-based jobs and how they are growing in the PDA. That right away triggered for me in terms of that tends to be something that as pointed out earlier, how it brings people in from outside. I would really push that's an opportunity to start looking at job training programs for the residents and that live in those areas already in the PDAs, because sometimes they're being trained for other things like construction jobs, but this really is where the future is. And so just a comment there. And the other one, I had a lot of other thoughts, but the last one is back on the kind of the affordability, affordable housing. Just wanted to mention that I think that it needs to be very clear that affordable housing is, and I think you're pointing it out in this as a challenge as well as a priority for finding that opportunity, and the loss of redevelopment funding is maybe an opportunity for the region to step in, both to advocate at the state level, but maybe even to do something at the regional level to kind of create that type of funding source that's being lost through the redevelopment. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. So I have Marshall, Tina, Agon, Richard, Sandy, Kathleen, and Frank. So, Marshall.
Well, actually, I hadn't expressed an interest in this one. It was another
matter. Okay, great. Tina.
Sorry.
Okay. Hi. Am I on?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. I think this is really, really well done. I'm very excited to see where this is at. And I have a couple of questions on the housing unit forecast. We talk about the group housing, in particular for seniors, but I don't see that as a strategy. So I'm wondering why it's not included in a strategy, because I don't think, it's my guess that cities aren't, it's not the most attractive residents for cities to provide, you know, low-income housing for seniors. They might want the jobs housing a little bit more. So can you address that a little bit? And then I have another question.
Sure. It's an issue that we need to do more work on. In the past, it hadn't been included at all, and it was, you know, sort of a, wow, that's an important thing to omit from a scenario for the region with a 130% increase in senior population coming forward. But right now, it's still a pretty conservative estimate. It assumes that, you know, we've got this big bump in the senior population, but the ratio of people is just tied to the increase. We haven't said there'll be, you know, sort of a process that with such a big population group, it's going to just, you know, create much more demand for those facilities, so the percentage would actually be higher. And we think there's need to do a lot more work on that issue in terms of location, in terms of how the number might shift over time. So it's one of the areas that we're going to do more analysis on in the coming weeks.
Okay, and can you explain quickly the fair share component? And then
sure.
I have a question about that.
Do you want to ask your question now so we can do
okay.
it all at once?
So what I'm looking to find out is my understanding is that so then 70% of the funds would be spent on things like rewarding cities and so that we ensure job housing balance and spending the money on within a half a mile of transit, let's say. Things like land use diversity, access to destination and intersection density, design for pedestrians. Is that where the majority, the 70% of the funds will go based on this methodology?
So what I'm hearing is you're making the relationship between the regional housing need allocation, the sustainability fair share component split, and the One Bay Area grant?
So, yeah, I guess I'm not. Can you explain to me the fair share component, and then I can see where I need to understand.
So when we kicked off this process of updating the regional housing need allocation for the next period, with a housing methodology committee that includes, you know, a bunch of stakeholders, a lot of local jurisdictional reps, a few electeds, there was a concerted effort to try to address the tension between sort of the traditional approach to RENA, which has been all about fair share, and sort of treating housing as a burden and making sure that every jurisdiction did its fair share, and that we, you know, statutorily we cannot and don't want to over-concentrate poverty in communities. That component with the requirements of SB 375, that you have a more efficient, focused land use pattern, which tends to mean more housing near transit, and so forth. And so the approach that has been arrived at is that for the allocation of housing in RENA to local jurisdictions, that 70% is based on growth allocated to the PDAs coming out of the scenario. So it will take whatever scenario is adopted, and it will inform 70% of the distribution for RENA. We then have some factors that we've worked on developing. The ABAG Executive Board is going to consider the release of these tomorrow night. Transit, employment, and RENA pass performance as factors to distribute the 30%. And a lot of the work around these factors went into, well, there are some places in the region that don't have PDAs. They might even have somewhat limited transit, but they have a lot of employment. And so there's a factor for net low-income commuters to look at suburban communities where a lot of people go into that community who don't make a lot of money, and there aren't many places for them to live in that jurisdiction. So that's sort of the fair share component. It really attempts to make sure that every jurisdiction is doing what it needs to do, ties it specifically to jobs and transit. And then the One Bay Area grant, the 70% reference, which is, I think, what you're pivoting off of, for the more urban counties, for the One Bay Area grant, 70% of the funds will have to be spent in the PDAs, and that was tied back to 70% of the RENA being directed to those jurisdictions. So it's attempting to say these jurisdictions are taking on a lot of housing, planning, and hopefully growth in the right places, and this is how the region's going to support them.
One more quick question. So does this address rewarding cities for permitting housing near, like, jobs, corporate parks, job campuses? Is that addressed?
Well, if a community with a number of corporate campuses would have a higher housing need number based upon this scenario. They might not consider that a reward, but there's a connection. The One Bay Area grant then we'll look at the amount of housing a jurisdiction is receiving, as well as whether or not it has a PDA, and there's a benefit for jurisdictions in terms of the amount of money they potentially will receive from the grant because of that relationship.
Thank you. All right. We have about 5 minutes left on this item, and I have Aegon, Richard, Sandy, Kathleen, and then Frank.
I'll try to be very quick. Ken, thank you. Glad we've gotten to this point. Bunch of good stuff to say about it. I'm going to start with just two concerns and then a couple of next steps that might be related to a motion. Concern/comment, one, your maps of PDAs by counties don't have transit on them. Should put transit on them. They just have highways and roads. So when it says transit corridor, transit town center, you don't know where that is. Second comment is more of an ABAG one, but I think it relates to our sort of broader perspective. There's a new definition of priority development areas embedded in this, and you've added an employment center PDA and a rural town center corridor PDA. And I know there's a lot of concern and talk about that definition generally. It makes it confusing to know how focused the growth is because you're relying so much on PDA percentages. And so as you look at this and you show this high percentage of growth going to PDAs, a portion of that is because PDAs have been redefined throughout this process. And so I'm flagging that as a major concern, I think, for the overall SCS. And I have an idea as it recommends going forward, but, I mean, that's The PDA is the PDA. That's the policy. But as it's gotten redefined, it's certainly not as focused. And Santa Clara colleagues, I think Coyote Valley, for example, is noted, and some huge industrial park in the northern part of Benicia, things that one might deem as sprawl are very big portions of the overall map. Very quickly on to kind of next steps then. One, I think the big idea, and I would maybe sort of put this in the form of a motion, hearing some of the things people have said.
Point of order.
I'm not
right. Hold on to that motion to propose something. You've done it twice. When you do this, then you end up closing the discussion. So could you hold off until everyone has had the chance to say what they want to say first?
Yeah. And everyone's going to have their chance in like 3 short minutes. And I'll come back to you.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll just make the comments then, and then we can come back as a motion. Is that okay, Dolly? Just to make them just
quick.
I just want it very quick. And these are the next steps. Point one, the money that comes from MTC as part of the RTP should adhere closely to the SCS land use scenario, or else what's the point? So we can turn that into motion. Point two. Land use alone is insufficient to meet the GHG goals. We need strong policies to get there, and the policies in this are insufficient. So I can turn that into a motion later, but those are just sort of two high-level ideas. Next step.
All right. Thank you. Richard. Well, you're splitting it with 4 other people.
Generally, I'm very supportive of this. Just a couple of comments. I have to agree with you about the renter rental housing going on out for a long time. I saw it last for over a generation during the Depression, and there was fewer houses lost during the Depression that have already been lost in this downturn. I was very disturbed, and I've already read the figures of the 6.6 full employment figure. I come from the days when Hubert Humphrey introduced the Humphrey-Hawkins bill that set full employment at 4%. At that time, 40% of our steel was manufactured here, or actually all of our steel was, the world's steel was manufactured here. We've lost tremendous amounts of manufacturing. I think that this agency, along with most of the other agencies that spend American dollars, should not just abide by what the law requires in American content, but should lead the way to start bringing American manufacturing back here, because we got some people that can only be fully employed when they can work in jobs like manufacturing jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Sandy? You're on. I think you turned it off.
There I go. Okay. Also make mine brief. Very supportive of many of the comments that have been mentioned, specifically by Bina, Randy, Tina, and Egon. I'm supportive of this connection. I think having a scenario focused on the connection is absolutely where we need to go, and the policies attached to it are going to be vital. If we're going to, one, meet our GHG reductions as well as plan for sustainability in general around all the E's that we're trying to focus on. So once we get to the motion, I really would like to focus on also adding a real strong emphasis around pushing for affordability and as well as looking at education and how we plan for making sure that our future generations are able to meet the jobs that our region will be producing.
Great, thanks. Before I take any more comments, if you have something blocking your mouthpiece here between you and the red dot on the wall, then we will get that scratchiness. It's a kind of infrared. That's what's feeding the machine. And so if you could make sure that there's nothing blocking your microphone, that would be great. With that, we have Sandy, and then Kathleen, and then Frank.
Again, I would congratulate staff on work, a lot of hard work, well done, and second the need for really strong policies. I had a couple of particular questions relating to the distribution methodology, and note that in jobs, we assume we're holding the 2010 employed resident per job ratio of 0.966 constant, and I'm wondering if that's actually valid across the demographic change that we're about to see with the aging of the boomers. That's question one. I don't know if you want to respond first or...
Sorry, could you repeat it again?
We are assuming an employed resident per job ratio
that will be held constant out to 2040. And I'm just wondering if we could really still expect to have 0.966 employed residents per job with so many people retiring.
There is a slight reduction in the percentage of residents who are within the workforce. That figure does change, but the jobs relationship is in part because of the number of unemployed. We have a huge number of unemployed people right now.
Who
so as those folks come back into the labor force, that's pretty much what's going on there.
Okay, thank you. And then the other is in terms of the housing distribution methodology on the VMT per household tiers. I noticed that was measured. The measure was modeled from the best performing SCS alternative scenario, but those were. We had two different transportation networks there, so I'm wondering how we can assume that those VMTs will hold when we don't yet know the transportation system that will be serving them.
This was specific to the land use. It wasn't tied, and this will sound like an incomplete answer. It wasn't tied directly to the difference in the transportation networks. It was looking at the locational issues modeled going forward. So it looks at both expected transit ridership, proximity to transit. It also looks at demographic factors, and it was kind of revealing in that respect how demographics affect how much people drive.
Okay. And then the other, sorry, if I may, one question I had and that's just concerning to me coming from a county that recently adopted what I consider a very, very rural PDA, inappropriately so. In one county in Marin, we're saying, okay, we're going to back off these numbers because you're not well served by transit and respect that, whereas in my county, and sorry to overly localize this, we have a completely an area that's poorly served by transit, yet we just allowed it to become a PDA. So I don't understand that, and I'll take it up with my commissioners too, but I can't support that.
So I'll just, this has come up a couple times, so I'll just touch base on it really quickly if I may. So yesterday, the ABAG Regional Planning Committee advanced a staff recommendation to defer, not eliminate, but defer the applications for rural center, corridor, and employment center PDAs to give them a closer look. From my perspective, I think there's more of an issue of nomenclature and confusion around that. There's good planning that needs to happen in some of the smaller rural communities, particularly in the rural counties. They feel like MTC and ABAG are so heavily oriented toward the cities that we barely even know they exist. They want a little piece of the pie. That's the issue on the rural front, but I'm not certain that the PDA framework is necessarily the way to get there. I think people they've kind of adopted the PDA brand, and they say that's not a PDA. On the employment center front, I don't think it's as problematic as some of the concerns suggest, because we have looked at housing near these areas, and they are also really, really important in the South Bay in terms of making a stronger employment transit connection and really transforming some of these places. But again, there are concerns that have been raised. So those were deferred to June, and we're going to spend a couple of months trying to look at some of the issues that have been raised and bringing it back.
Thank you.
Frank.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Some of us were at a previous meeting, the equity analysis. The issue of housing was discussed in detail. I'm wondering if you'll be able to get hold of some of the minutes, since I don't hear some of the issues raised and the strategies presented for handling some of the problems have not been discussed yet. I'm primarily interested in meeting the needs of low-income workers who want housing, affordable housing. There has not been a sustained strategy to assist them to own fair market value housing by actually tapping into all the various subsidies available to them from federal, state, and county jurisdiction. In some instances, folks are able to actually pay about 50% of their market value dwelling. the house is $500,000. They will buy the house for $500,000, but because of the subsidies, the actual cost becomes $250,000. And they are able to live there, and it's not a cheap house, it's not a poor quality housing. That is usually what is envisaged when it's affordable housing. It's a cheap housing. But these people are able to live in the same house, in the same communities. And we have to try and develop a strategy to help folks in that particular avenue. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that, I think, relates back to that slide about supporting lower income affordability on housing, so a diversity of housing units to be produced.
And
thank you.
As I mentioned, there's been a lot of policy work. It's being sort of improved right now. We can provide the links to Pam so that she can provide them to all of you so that you can access those documents, and you can look at what's been done this far, and then we'd be happy to come back again in the future if you'd like us to.
Great. So that email follow through then will be incumbent upon us to go back to those links and read through it to see what the strategies in other communities are that are occurring. That's a speaker's list, and Egon, you wanted to come back with a motion, I think?
If I can try to summarize this very specifically, that it sounds like, based on the comments, I make a motion that the Policy Advisory Council generally supports the direction of the new proposed scenario, and that it focuses the Bay Area's growth in a more concentrated manner, and that we have two recommendations going forward. One is to develop much more specific policies to help achieve a more concentrated and focused growth pattern. The policies don't speak to that very much. And the second is for MTC, in its allocation of funding for projects in the regional transportation plan, adhere to the land use vision and goal of the adopted scenario, that they don't become two disconnected documents, but that we really want to hold MTC to the funding reality shaping the land use vision of this. Because in the end, that was the point of SC.
Second.
It was a race to second, but I think Tina beat you out there. Okay, so let me just make sure I understand this motion. It's generally to support the recommendation, the recommended scenario, but with two recommendations. One, to develop much more specific policies to achieve the scenario.
To achieve the concentrated growth goal of the scenario.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then second, that MTC adhere to the land use vision when distributing dollars, but that's kind of where I lost it.
Right, that as MTC votes on the regional transportation plan, that they do so in accordance with the land use vision of the SCS.
Great, thank you. And then I have Sandy wanting to speak on the motion. And then, literally, you guys, this is what happens every meeting. Just, I hate to be the bad guy here, and we have some heavy agenda items, but we need to move on. So if you want to speak to the motion, be specific. And if you agree, great. Maybe your comment doesn't. If you agree with someone else, maybe you can just pass. Sandy.
I just want to add the friendly amendment to the first point, that the policies also, that we strongly recommend that the policies have to address the affordability issue.
Is that a friendly?
Sure.
Thank you. Doesn't need a second. Okay. Tina. Egon's going to take that as a friendly. Do you agree? Thank you. Any other comments to the motion? Questions and called? So the motion has received this, is willing to take this friendly, yay, to underscore our point. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions. That motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much, Ken, and thank you to the committee here for the hard work in helping this go forward.
Thank you very much. And I would just quickly note that we will be here tomorrow night before the AVAG Executive Board at 7 o'clock. If any of you would like to attend and have a really good policy discussion, you would be heartily welcomed. So let's put that out.
Wow, thank you.
Actually, it would be advisable to attend. They may need some support.
There may be people there who may not support our position, is what I'm hearing. So, all right. Our next item on the agenda is the DBE and Title VI update. And I'm going to suggest that if we have questions on this, welcome, Denise. Thank you for being patient. If we have questions on this item, because you've had the report now to read over, maybe that's where we go to first to see what the questions are for this. No questions? Okay, Denise, is there anything specific you want to point out to us?
The only thing, I'm Denise Rodriguez, and I'm contract compliance manager here at MTC. I think the report is pretty self-explanatory. A couple things I wanted to point out, though, are changes to the DBE program. Last year, there was a final rule change that required us or all agencies to have an SBE component to a small business enterprise component to the disadvantaged business enterprise program. We're part of Caltrans disadvantaged business enterprise program, and so we will do whatever it is that they tell us to do. The memo does outline activities that we undertake to try to persuade SBEs to do business with us or contract with us, ways to inform them about our contract opportunities and things like that. One of those things is to provide technical assistance, and we'll be working with the Department of Transportation. We'll actually be hosting their bonding education program that here in the auditorium. It's going to be a 6 to 8 week program. We haven't determined the length of the program. It'll definitely be 6 weeks, but we're not sure if it'll fully go to 8 weeks, from 4 to 7 p.m. Here in the auditorium. It's a program where we're looking to get those firms who are ready to get to the next step. Mm-hmm. So they can't get bonding. You know, they're able to get insurance, but bonding is a little bit different. And maybe they can get bonds at $200,000. This program will bring sureties in, really coach those firms and move them to the next step where they can get those bigger jobs and become primes and things like that. So if there are any firms in your area or anyone you'd like to refer to the program, please let Pam know, or I can give my business card. We really want to make sure we get those firms who are, you know, they're teetering on the edge and they need that little bit of coaching. This course will give that to them. And there's a link in the a memo, but I also printed out information on the bonding education program that I'll have by the pass out, and I believe there is enough copies for everyone, and if there isn't, I can go make some more. The only other thing is just a very brief Title VI update. As you all know, we had our Title VI compliance review back in September of last year, and we're still awaiting the results of that review. We expect to have them soon, and as soon as we get them, of course, we'll share them with you all.
Great. Thank you, Denise. So I guess I'm surprised we didn't have any questions, but I was a little discouraged in terms of the DBE breakdown that just in general, our numbers are not, of course, in parity with our region's population. And as I look at the flyer for the upcoming workshops, for example, VTA is a partner, at least on the flyer. So does that mean that their VTA is also sending this workshop information out to the companies that they do business with under DBE to make them more knowledgeable about these workshops?
Yeah, and the workshop isn't just for DBEs. It's for, you know, really any firm who needs that help. Of course, we'd like to see DBEs and SBEs primarily, but anyone can come. Okay. No, all of the transportation agencies in the region are working along with DOT. We just happen to be hosting because of our proximity to BART and things like that.
Okay.
But what DOT has asked though, is that it really is not just those firms who are just getting started, but really those firms who are really ready to get to the next step. And
okay.
Bonding is now a barrier for them.
Right.
And this class is really meant to bring them to the table, help them get their financials in order, so that when a surety looks at them, they can get that bond for $750,000 or something and get that job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
And the, just to answer your question also on the DB participation,
mm-hmm.
I did want to point out that as you'll see, it dipped really
yes.
low in 08-09, and then in 09-10 it actually went up. And that was the first year, the first full fiscal year, where UDB goals were put back in place.
Right.
Now, there is a spike there, and I think that will continue to go up in fiscal year 10-11, because that was the first year goals were put back in place. So those contracts had just started.
Okay.
And so some of those probably maybe only been like 3 months into that fiscal year, or maybe 6 months, where 10-11 should give us a really good picture.
A full year.
Yeah, a full year.
Okay.
And so I'm working on those now, and as soon as that information is available, I'll bring that to the committee as well.
All right, great. Thank you. Any other questions, Lori?
Okay, real quick. Do you is there any way of actually assessing the number of DBEs or SBEs that can so that we can determine how many businesses are actually out here working?
There is a the California Unified Certification Program mm-hmm. has a database
okay.
of contractors. That are certified, because you have to be certified as a DBE you can't just be, you know, there's certification criteria that you have to go through. So that website is actually available on the MTC website, okay. and I can send that link to Pam to give to you.
Okay.
It's a pretty massive database, but that information is there. And then you can break it down to see how many ready, willing, and able DBEs are certified within the state of California, and then also, say, District 4 and our 9 counties.
Okay.
So, and that's how we develop goals to see.
And what can cities do to ensure that this goal is being met as well? I know we have first source hiring policies, but they're not always the best.
Yeah.
What can we ensure that when we're soliciting for contracts, and looking at this goal of maybe, you know, giving like 1% or 5%, ensuring that DBEs or the SBEs have contracts with us, what is the best way of doing that? Can
well,
we use someone with the same policy?
Well, under federal contracts, this rule applies to federal contracts only. So even here at MTC, because, you know, various other... But what we do on an ongoing basis is not just apply the goal and then say, okay, great, you're going to meet this with 4%. See ya, give us a final report when you're done 4 years from now. And then we end up seeing they do 1%. What we request and what we require, and we'll withhold payment if they don't provide it to us on a monthly basis, is tell us their usage of the DBEs. And that way we know on an ongoing basis, and then we can see, you know, maybe there was, oh, they're ramping up the initial, you know, the initial part of the contract, and so they haven't used the DBE yet, but we'll have that conversation with them ahead of time. And then they say, okay, we're going to use them a year and a half in to do some outreach or something. Okay, well, we want to see that on, you know, your invoice and your monthly report at that point. So there's sort of an ongoing monitoring. So I don't know what kind of programs, you know, various cities have, but I think that's the biggest thing to do. Otherwise, you wait till the end, what's your stick, right? So that's what we do here at MTC, and part of the new rule that went into effect last year as well is for... if your contractor isn't meeting those goals, you should come up with a corrective action plan for them to say, okay, well, you know, sometimes they'll say, well, the DBE isn't doing the work, or I call them and they're not available. That doesn't work for us. We want to have a conversation. So ongoing monitoring, conversation, and really keeping somebody's feet to the fire on it. Yeah.
Great. All right. Any other questions, comments? Moving on to item number 8, the staff liaison report. Pam, that's you. We missed you.
Thank you so much. I missed you guys last month, too, but
yeah, sure
I heard all about it. So in my report, just a couple things to note. Well, let me just say, first of all, that if you weren't aware, we have this annual report to Congress that comes out each year during this time. It's during the time when there is a big discussion that's happening in Washington, D.C. about transportation dollars, which is the reason that Steve's not here today. But this report is available. I've left copies over there on the table, so I don't believe it was sent to you, so please feel free to take one if you're interested in the bigger picture, the bigger discussion that plagues us all. And then also in the report, I've got a special meeting that's coming up on Tuesday, April 3rd. You'll recall last fall we had a discussion on express lanes in the Bay Area, and we didn't quite finish that discussion. I'm sure everyone left thinking, well, gee, we have more to say. And so staff has been discussing this in the last month because it is coming back. Most of you know that the state did approve us to go forward with that idea, and so we want to continue that discussion with you at a special meeting next month. Unfortunately, we can't get this room, so it means we're back in, I call it the dungeon room next door. I hope that doesn't bode badly, that that was the same room we were in last time we had this discussion. But we'll be next door in rooms, conference room 171, Tuesday, April 3rd at 1:30 for that meeting. So maybe just send an email, let Leela or I know if you can or cannot make that date and time, so we can make sure whether or not we have a quorum for that meeting. Rich.
Just a little heads up. Somebody sent me an article recently that it did, in so many words, accused MTC of planning a private-public partnership to administer the lanes. And somebody's probably going to bring that up, so you might want to be able to address it.
Oh, great. Okay. Hang on, Frank, is this specific to that April 3rd meeting? Okay, Pam.
Okay, and then just a reminder that your terms have been extended through July 2013. The commission did approve that. And then you had asked for a full evaluation report, and we did forward that on to you. And we will be going out for recruitment for our vacancies next month, so stay tuned for that. We do have a deadline coming up on our transportation awards program. Every other year we do do an awards program and just kind of recognize people or programs that are helping us to move around a little bit better in the Bay Area. So if you know of any programs that you'd like to nominate, we welcome more nominations. We always want more. And that deadline is coming up March 31st. So please feel free to get those in. You could send them to me if you want. But we also have Terry Lee's information in that for you. And I think that's all.
You just gave us a letter from one of the commissioners.
It's a former BART board director. Okay. Yeah, so I just forwarded it as requested. So.
Okay. Benna.
Announcements. As some of you may know, we had some really good news this past week for the BART to Silicon Valley first phase extension to the Berryessa Station. We signed the full funding grant agreement with the Federal Transit Administration for $900 million. They came with $100 million, which was really nice. I wanted to let you know there's going to be a groundbreaking ceremony on April 12th, and the leadership group is actually hosting a luncheon right before that groundbreaking ceremony with Senator Dianne Feinstein, and wanted to extend an invitation to all of you to attend that event. So, Pam, if I could send the formal invitation to you, I'd love to distribute it to all the committee members here. We'd love to have you come. Thanks.
Great. That should be an exciting event. Lori?
Are we on new business?
We are on council member reports.
Oh, I'll wait.
Any other council member reports? Randy?
I attended the ribbon cutting / train ride for both the Dearden and the Santa Clara stations with their new improvements, which were billed as the first completed ERA programs in the state of California. It was great. And I also want to thank Aegon for an awesome reception that he threw and party for Spur in San Jose. It was great.
I do want to ask something under new business. Sorry, I didn't read.
Okay, we're not in new business yet.
I mean, council member
reports.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So if you have an opportunity, members, please go on the City of Richmond's website and see our Easy Go transportation project. We have stationed electric and hybrid vehicles in low income residential complexes for use by the tenants, and anyone in the community can actually come into that complex and use these vehicles. We have a kids cab that gets children to and from school and after school activities, and we also have a weekend van service. So if you ever would like to go maybe to Reno or something like that, you can take a hybrid van. And it's really good because the residents don't have to pay any insurance. This program covers insurance costs for anyone who's driving the vehicle, anyone in the vehicle. It's a very low cost, $3 an hour, and actually you get half of a rebate, 50% rebate back off of that. And everyone's loving it, including myself. So go on the website, cityofrichmond.org. to take a look at what we offer there. We have the station in three different locations. We also have LBNL. If you don't know, the Lawrence Berkeley Livermore Lab have decided to make their second campus or have the second campus in the city of Richmond. So we're also planning transportation development around that. Now, even though I represent Vallejo, these programs, I'm saying this because these same programs, I'm trying to ensure that they come to the city of Vallejo. And I'm sure that if you are interested enough, maybe they can come into your communities as well. Thank you.
Any other council member reports? Great. Then let us go on to new business. Lori?
Oh, no, I'm done.
No new business?
The annual report to Congress, MTC, it's very good. I'm going to suggest that next year's report should have PAC's chairman and vice chairman included in it, and just mention the work of the PAC with the chairman and the vice chairman name included in the report.
Okay. Any other Nokia?
It's Yokia.
I have a it's Yokia. Yes, I have a question. Has there been any studies about land use in the homeless population, like the homeless, like living in the land? Like I see it, you know, low income, but I don't see anything about what happens when we start doing stuff and there's camps and there's stuff that there are people that are there, you know, because we're assuming that low income is people that have income. And then with the war and with the vet and the stuff that happens with the mental illness and stuff like that, I think we'll see a large percentage of people living on the street.
Great point, Yokia. I mean, I don't know that MTC has done anything, and I'm not sure what the breadth of ABAG's research has been. I know in Santa Clara County, and I suspect the other counties in the region, we all do homeless counts and try and figure out how do we provide for more shelters, even if it's seasonal shelters, and that's mostly what it is, as well as develop programs to getting homeless off of the streets and into housing over their head, so to speak. But perhaps I could ask Pam to follow up on that and send that or bring it to us at our next meeting.
Yeah, we can check with the library and see what.
Great. And then Sandy and Richard.
Lori, thanks so much for sharing about your Easy Go program. I would personally love to hear more about that program and how the liability is being covered. And, I mean, I personally would love to hear more about it. I think it could potentially be a great program for many cities to adopt.
Yeah, just a comment about that's a good point. A good source for that information could be organizations like the Interfaith Council, you know, on our peninsula. My church houses homeless families who have income. They just don't have enough.
Okay, before you scurry away, any other new business? So I heard something, I heard a couple of things today, and part of that was how do we address legislation. The two pieces of legislation that I noted were using Medicaid dollars for assisted living and reconstitute. How can we reconstitute redevelopment in the spirit in which it was originally supposed to be utilized for? And so, Pam, if you could, in your research, see where that falls under the guise of MTC, and then maybe you and I can touch base. I think that would be good. And did I hear Alex say that there's a discussion that they're formulating on a regional fair policy?
That was
the other issue that was raised.
Right. It's listed among a set of policies on the kind of a back end series of papers that I think went out to the TSP. Right. We didn't get it. It came out later. There's a steering committee meeting tomorrow. The suggestion I had made, if others are interested, is that figuring out how that would work, essentially if you're transferring between a local system and a regional system, do you get paid double? Do you have to, you know, do you get a cut on the fare? A whole series of things. Lots of places do it better in the Bay Area. Could this policy board take a look at that and maybe help come up with some policy ideas?
And then I think more immediately it's also being fielded in the regional economic opportunities report, but that's a low-income, I think, means-tested, discounted fare. Okay.
Just a rubber to the road on the redevelopment issue. I think if we limited it to PDAs, Steinberg, and in the spirit of Senate Bill 375, and we might get some help on that with Steinberg. He terms out 2014, so we'll have to move.
Other than that, this meeting is adjourned. Thanks for your hard work.